This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is Lecture 6, given in Dornach on March 26, 1920. I have some concern about what I am going to present today. If I had 3 months to explain these ideas, you would find it difficult to take them as mere fantasies. The material that follows involves specialized aspects of healing, but during this hour today, I can present these ideas only briefly, in an attempt to make them fully comprehensible to you. Consequently, many statements will seem purely arbitrary. Nevertheless, through my manner of presenting them, I will attempt to demonstrate that all of these thoughts are at least as well-founded as those assumptions upon which modern science is built. I would like to begin today by showing you the process of plant development as such in its cosmic context. I have already drawn your attention to the fact that the inverse of this process is active in the human being on the functional level. This process of plant development needs to be described, at least sketchily, if we are to discover the plant world's direct connection to the human being. If you look at plants, you will find that their overall developmental process incorporates two distinctly opposite tendencies. One works toward the earth. I pointed out yesterday that the earth is mounded up, as it were, in the trunks or stems of woody plants, so that a tree's flowers and leaves are rooted in the trunk, in the same way that merely herbaceous plants are, or still lower plants, are rooted in the ground. This points to the plant's earth-directed tendency, on the one hand. But, on the other hand, the plant strives upward, away from the earth. It does so not only through a mechanical force that counteracts earth's gravity, but also in all of its developmental processes, even the internal ones. The processes taking place in the flower become differentiated from those taking place in the root. Flower processes become much more dependent than root processes on forces from outside the earth. The dependence of flower formation on forces that do not truly belong to the earth is the first thing we must look at. Because of the reversal of the plant process in the human being on the functional level, a reversal I pointed to in earlier lectures, we will find that the forces used by the plant to initiate flower and seed formation are also present in the human abdomen, in elimination, secretion, and the organic basis of sexuality. Therefore, when we find this connection between the human being and the plant, even the details point to both extra-telluric and earthly processes in the plant. I must not omit to make you aware of the fact that what I am presenting here has not been taken from ancient medical works, but is based on present-day spiritual scientific research. Some of my terminology, however, harkens back to this ancient literature, because modern medical literature has not yet developed a terminology of its own in this field. But you would be very mistaken if you were to believe that anything presented here is derived exclusively from ancient writings. If you follow the process of plant growth as it moves upward, away from the earthly element, the first thing to become aware of is the spiral path of development of both leaves and flowers. The plant's formative forces trace a spiral of sorts around the stem. This spiral path cannot be deduced from inner forces of tension within the plant, but must be attributed to extra-telluric influences and especially to the effects of the apparent path of the sun. I say, quote, apparent, close quote, advisedly, because the earth's motion in relationship to the sun must be considered only relative, hence I say the apparent path of the sun. In certain respects, the clues to the movement of the stars that are found in the path of a plant's developmental processes are much better than Galileo's mathematical clues, because the plant is a faithful replica of what the stars are doing. We would go completely astray, however, if we believed that the only developmental path that is active in the plant is the sun-dependent one that moves upward from the earth. In fact, the workings of the stars are combined with the movements of our planetary system that are brought about by the sun. The sun force would take possession of plants completely and make them continue into infinity, if it in turn were not counteracted by the forces of the so-called outer planets and their spirals. In actuality, the planets move in spirals rather than in ellipses. By now, the entire Copernican view of the universe should be re-examined and replaced with another one. We must count Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn as belonging to the so-called outer planets. Uranus and Neptune belong to our solar system only from a purely astronomical point of view. They actually entered the solar system as foreign bodies and were received as, quote, guests, close quote. So we are right to disregard them. In any case, the forces of the outer planets cause the upward-directed force to retreat. They bring about the development of flowers and fruit by restraining what would otherwise be expressed only in the spiral of the leaves. If you study plant growth above the leaves, you must attribute its origin to the forces that come about as the result of the sun working together with Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Not only do these two elements work together, however, but they are also counteracted by what comes from the moon, in particular, and also from the so-called inner planets Mercury and Venus. Mercury, Venus, and the moon engender the downward, earth-directed tendency in the plant. Their most characteristic expression lies in the development of roots. Everything that appears earthly is actually simultaneously influenced by the moon and the inner planets. You might say that the plant is an expression of our entire solar system. Until we know how this solar system manifests in plants, on the one hand, and in human beings, on the other, we cannot truly grasp the connection between the plant world and the human organism. All you need to do is look at the fact that when you burn plants that tend to be rooty, that is, plants that are less involved in the process of flower and seed formation than those that tend toward flower formation, or the roots of any plant, the ash has many more constituents than it does when you burn flowers, mistletoe, or woody plants. This difference is simply due to the fact that the forces of the inner planets, the forces of Moon, Mercury, and Venus, have more effect on plants that tend strongly toward root formation. In their ashes you will find iron, manganese, silica, in short, constituents that are direct remedies and function as such whenever anything derived from these plants is administered. In contrast, you find fewer constituents in the ash that results from burning the opposite type of plants. What is thus expressed in the combustion process is first and foremost a real outer documentation of the fact that the plant belongs not only to what can be found on Earth, but also to the entire cosmos. Look at the process of plant growth more thoroughly. If we are dealing with annual plants, the process breaks off at a certain season and draws to a close in seed formation. Thus we must attribute seed formation primarily to supra-earthly factors. The process is broken off, handed over to the earthly element. Something that achieved a certain higher level in the old year must continue at a lower level in the new year. You can see a peculiar process in the totality of plant growth. Imagine that this is the earth's surface, and here you have the entire plant growing out of the earth toward the super-earthly influences. What is shaped by these influences is returning to the earth. What is shaped by these influences is returned to the earth, and the cycle begins again. If you consider plant growth as a totality, each year the heavenly forces sink down into the earth to unite with the earth's forces and repeat the cycle. Each year the heavenly forces submerge the flowering, fruiting element into the root element to bring about the cycles to which all plant growth is subject. This picture points out that when we consider the earth's flora, we are actually concerned with the interaction between the earth as a whole and factors beyond earth. This interaction extends not only to plant structure, but also to a plant's internal chemical activity and its entire system of organs. Just as earthly mechanics are overcome in the human form, extra-telluric factors also overcome the earthly chemical activity in the plant. But once it has been overcome to a certain extent, it must be reincorporated into the earthly element to produce earthly chemical activity. At this point, you are not far from the realization that earthly chemical activity is outwardly evident in ash and everything ash stands for. That is, earthly chemical activity can be expressed by what falls out of the realm of the living. Non-living substances, however, are subject to gravity, while the upward growth of the plant constantly overcomes gravity and other earthbound forces, so that we can speak of gravity and light as polar opposites. Light is what constantly overcomes gravity, and in a certain way the plant is enmeshed in this struggle between heaviness and light, between what longs to become ash and what longs to become fire. Here we are pointed toward the polar opposites of ash formation and what manifests in fire, to the contrast between the tangible and the intangible. Here we have the plant world in its cosmic context. You will also find, according to our discussions of previous days, that it is impossible to understand the human being without imagining human orientation as polar. I described how in a plant what grows from below upward grows in the human being from above downward, and as a result in the human being the flowering and fruiting process works downward in sexual and excretory processes, while the rooting process works upward. The difference is that this is a process of function in the human being and a process of matter in the plant. From this you can see that we discover something in the human being that is the opposite of what we find in the plant. In the human being, however, we encounter not only the opposite process, but also the bearer of that process. At the human being's functional level, you have an element that roots upward, and the growing plant-like element that moves downward. On the other hand, these elements are surrounded by the material aspect, which also tends to move upward from below. In this way, a process that would have to be artificially induced in the plant, removing something from the upper sphere and submerging it in the lower, takes place continuously in the human being. The processes whose tendency is to work from above downward, and those that work from below upward, are always working together. Human illness or health is determined by this interplay. You see, we do not understand complicated human processes at all if we fail to consider what I have just described. That on the one hand a carrier is present that works upward from the earth, while on the other hand a force inserts itself into this carrier and works downward from above. How human illness and well-being are determined by this interplay of forces can easily be seen when, in some desperation, we confront a very important fact, namely that the human organism requires quite different therapy, depending on whether its upper parts or the parts below the heart come into consideration. The human being must be seen according to different principles in these two instances. This fact is expressed in phenomena such as the often mystifying relationship between craniotabes and ordinary rickets. Craniotabes, it's spelled C-R-A-N-I-O-T-A-B, as in boy, E-S, refers to a progressive decrease in calcification or emaciation of the skull. I'm going to pronounce that, I'm afraid, craniotabes and ordinary rickets. End of footnote. Those who view the human being as a unity consider these two conditions to be very closely related, though it must be understood that they are governed by different principles, since they originate in opposite parts of the human being. In a significant way, this difference extends even to the healing process. Physicians who report some success in treating rickets with phosphorus will probably not have the slightest success if they apply this treatment to craniotabes, which would need the opposite type of treatment, possibly with some sort of calcium carbonate or the like. I would like to say, however, that this example is only an expression of a very general state of affairs that is somewhat uncomfortable to mention, but is nonetheless very true. Namely, that whenever we are dealing with medical treatment of human beings, if any statement can be made, its exact opposite can also be the right solution in certain cases. This, you see, is the fatal aspect of the question. It is completely possible for someone to cite a totally correct course of treatment for one or the other illness, yet it may be no treatment at all for symptoms that appear to be exactly the same, for which the exact opposite course would have to be implemented. As a result, one theory of healing in medicine can always be forced to give way to another, if we are not aware that one method of therapy treats only one part of the human being, and that another part will require a different therapeutic method. This is what we have to realize. It is important to take a good look at what we encounter as existing separately in the plant and as one aspect of the human organization. Yesterday I drew your attention to the three formative impulses inherent in the outer non-human natural world: the salt-like and mercurial formative impulses, and the impulse consisting of certain substances such as phosphorus or sulfur, inasmuch as they are carriers of intangibles and store up the forces of these intangible factors within themselves. With regard to what I said yesterday, what are the differences among these three formative impulses intrinsic to the non-human natural world? All processes that are salt-like, or, to put it better, lead to the formation of salts, guide inner processes into the domain of gravity. Those who read ancient medical texts would do well to consider the following discussion whenever there is talk of substances becoming salt-like. Through this process, the force of the substance in question becomes subject to gravity, whereas through the opposite process, the light process, intangibles are withdrawn from the force of gravity. If we think of light as representing all other intangibles, we must also imagine the all-pervasive struggle between light and gravity in the non-human natural world. The struggle between a force that aspires to become supra-earthly and one that makes earthly substances tend to draw toward the center. What we first see here is the contrast between gravity and light and the constant alternating search for balance between them. This is expressed by the mercurial principle, which consists of nothing other than the constant search for balance between light and gravity. The point is to incorporate the differences that exist among the salt-like, phosphoric, and mercurial principles into the context of the entire cosmos, into gravity, into light, and into the contrast between them, the search for balance. You see, in a strange way, the entire activity of the human heart finds its place within this contrast. The most disastrous thing about our modern scientific view, aside from the pump theory it applies to the heart, which is totally untenable, as I have already explained, is that it thinks every activity has to run its course entirely within the confines of the skin of the being in question. Today we imagine the heart's connections as being more or less limited to what is pulsing through the body. But this is not the case. Through having organs, the human being is incorporated into the entire cosmic process, and the human heart not only is an organ within the human organism, but also belongs to this cosmic process. What is played out in the plant, in the interaction of influences coming from the inner or outer planets, is also played out within the human being, coming to expression in the movements of the heart. The heart's movements are not only an expression of what is going on within, but also an imprint of circumstances external to the human being. If you consider the human heart, the entire cosmic process is essentially reflected in it. Human beings are individualized only in that they are beings of soul and spirit. On the other levels, they are incorporated into the entire cosmic process by virtue of the fact, to use one example, that the beating human heart is an expression not of something happening within the individual, but of the struggle between light and gravity that is played out in the entire cosmos. I have often attempted to describe human integration with the cosmos to lay audiences in a crudely illustrative way by making use of the following calculation. If you assume that a human being takes approximately 18 breaths a minute, you will find that the number of breaths in a 24-hour day comes to 25,920. If you take a single day in the life of a human being, consider that there are 365 days in a year, and assume that the maximum human lifespan averages 71 years, although people can live to be much older, you come up with almost exactly the same number of days in a human lifetime as there are breaths in a 24-hour day, 29,915. And if you look at the sun's course through the entire zodiac, that is a Platonic year, the length of time that the sun's rising point at the vernal equinox takes to move once around the zodiac, it also takes 25,920 years. This number is a remarkable example of how the human being is connected to the entire cosmos, because the Platonic year of the sun's course through the zodiac turns out to have as many years as there are days in a human lifetime. This circumstance can be illustrated quite concretely, but it leads us into extraordinary depths in the existence of the cosmos. You simply need to keep in mind something else that we have to emphasize in anthroposophy, that the I and the astral body withdraw from the physical and etheric bodies when a human being sleeps and move back in when the person wakes up. Simply imagine this as a sort of exhalation and inhalation of the soul and spirit of the physical body, and you have 25,915 or 25,920, leap years account for the discrepancy, of the type of breaths that are completed during a human lifetime, which must constitute a day on some other level. And in turn, there must be something in the cosmos that relates an apparent revolution of the sun to this same number. Here you have a rhythm in the cosmos that is expressed first on the grand scale, then in an individual human lifetime, and then in the respiratory processes of a single day. It will no longer seem astonishing to you that the prehistoric world of atavistic clairvoyance spoke of the days and nights of Brahma, of the inhalation and exhalation of the cosmos, because people back then had discovered that this cosmic inhalation and exhalation has a microcosmic image in the daily process of human life. It is through such very concretely based observations, and not through sympathies or antipathies of any sort, that we actually achieve a real reverence for ancient wisdom. I can assure you that I myself would be no admirer of ancient wisdom if I had not convinced myself in countless instances that we are now rediscovering ancient truths that had totally disappeared in the interim. Anyone who truly strives for insight does not learn to revere ancient wisdom because of some general attraction to it. This reverence develops directly out of an understanding of very concrete relationships. If we want to find the light-like element, we must look at everything that lies beyond the sun in our solar system, at Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. And since everything that happens on the Earth is in some sense a result of forces that exist outside the Earth, we must look for the effects of cosmic events in the earthly element. Consequently, we do not look for reasons for the configuration or the solid state of earthly substances in as abstract and fantastical a way as modern molecular physics or molecular and atomic chemistry do. Atomic chemistry looks into subjects we cannot really look into, namely the innermost constitution of solid bodies. It comes up with all kinds of fine notions about atoms and molecules, and then talks about its, quote, astronomical understanding, close quote, of what is going on inside a solid structure. Parenthesis, this may not be so much the case today, but it is how scientists were talking very proudly a few decades ago. Close parenthesis. Today, these inner workings are being photographed, as I said in my public lecture the day before yesterday. Footnote, Anthroposophy and the Modern Sciences, a lecture given on March 24, 1920, published in Volume 5 of Geisteswissenschaft und die Lebensforderungen der Gegenwart, Spiritual Science and the Demands of Modern Life, Dornach, 1950. End of footnote. In spiritualist circles, however, photographs of spirits are also being taken. And since today scientists are not inclined to believe in spirit photography, they should allow others who understand these matters to refuse to believe in their photographs of atoms, which are subject to the same factors as spirit photography. The forces we are concerned with in plants are not the same as the forces that are bound to atoms and molecules. The forces in plants work into earthly substance from outside the earth. In an earthly substance, it is not these demonic little atoms and molecules that cause its configuration, but rather the cosmic forces that are working in a particular way. Let us say that a constellation outside the earth consists of Saturn being in a position to work on a certain location on Earth in an especially beneficial way, and that its effect is most advantageous when other lines of influence, the effects of the Sun, Mars, and so forth, are as far away from its own as possible, and do not lie in or near its path. In this instance, Saturn is working alone in a certain respect. If, for other reasons, our Earth is then especially receptive or favorably disposed to these Saturn forces at the location in question, the Saturn forces, which in this case are influenced very little by other extra-telluric forces, bring about a particular structure in earthly matter that is different from what is produced when Mars, for example, works under the same conditions. Earthly substances are nothing other than the products of the interaction of stellar forces. In the example I have chosen here, where Saturn works on certain parts of the Earth for longer periods of time, and under favorable circumstances, its effects become visible in the product. We are dealing here with the coming about of lead. This is the reason why certain earthly substances, especially metals, must be linked to certain constellations in the extra-telluric cosmos. Here, again, there is an inevitable parallelism between what modern spiritual scientific research has to offer and what was formerly offered by ancient wisdom, which can be understood today only if it is discovered anew. These ancient writings are almost unreadable for modern individuals who think in terms of chemistry or physics. This can be illustrated by an example recorded by a very intelligent Scandinavian scholar in his History of Alchemy. He described a process that, as he very correctly stated, is nonsense according to modern chemical concepts, because it does not lead to any discovery. Footnote: Theodor Svedberg, 1884-1971, Swedish chemist who received the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 1926. Presumably this comment refers to his book Matter, 1912, which appeared in German translation in 1914. End of footnote. The process in question was a lead process, but this worthy gentleman failed to realize that the explanation applied to the process of seed formation. Footnote: the word lead is missing in the German typescript of this lecture and was inserted because of its correspondence to the process of seed formation. End of footnote. Instead, he believed that it applied to a process taking place in the laboratory, and on that level it is indeed nonsense. Because the terminology needs to be transferred to an entirely different level, we must think of meanings other than the usual when we read certain expressions. Because he did not realize this, for him it was nonsense, and he was both right and wrong. We cannot avoid bringing earthly substances into connection with the forces that work on the earth from its surroundings, especially the study of metals, if carried out in ways that I will describe in these lectures, brings us to very specific connections, such that we must attribute lead, first and foremost, to the undisturbed effects of Saturn, tin to the undisturbed effects of Jupiter, iron to Mars, copper to Venus, and what chemistry now calls Mercury to the planet of the same name. This is why the ancients gave the name Mercury to both the planet and the metal. We must also recognize the relationship of everything that is like silver in character, I very deliberately said like silver, to the undisturbed effects of the moon. It is really amusing to read in modern scientific literature that silver's relationship to the moon was suggested by the moon's silvery sheen, and that people thought only in terms of this outer characteristic. Anyone who knows how carefully the ancient studies of individual metals were conducted in their own way will not succumb to this sort of error. you will see that there is also ample opportunity for other substances to develop. Because the ones that I listed, lead, tin, iron, copper, mercury, and silver, are only the most outstanding examples. The fact that other planetary influences competed with those just mentioned, for example, the lines of influence of Mars and Saturn could have intersected, made it possible for other substances to arise. This is how the less representative metals came about. In any case, we must see the Earth's metals as resulting from the influence of extra-telluric forces. At this point, however, what is expressed in the workings of metals merges with what we see in plant development, because if you take the active principles in lead, tin, or iron, these same principles must also be inherent in all aspects of the development of flowers and seeds, insofar as these processes take place outside the earthly element and above the surface of the earth. Similarly, all aspects of plant root formation must be connected to everything that is coppery, mercurial, or silvery in character. While the mercurial principle exists as a certain balance on the one hand, on the other you will, naturally, have to look for a different balance. Mercury is the balance between earthly and supra-earthly factors. In reality, however, our entire universe is pervaded with spirit, and here another polarity sets in. If you imagine the earthly element here and there the supra-earthly element, you have the contrast between light and gravity in the earthly and supra-earthly factors. But this gives you only the possibility of looking at a balance between these two factors. There is also another state of balance between the all-pervading element that does not distinguish between earthly and extra-telluric, and the elements it pervades, that is, between spirit and matter, regardless of whether matter is construed as tangible or intangible. At every point in the material element, even in the cosmos, the balance must be maintained between matter and the spirit. The nearest cosmic body that maintains this balance is the sun itself. The sun holds the balance between the spiritual and the material in the cosmos. For this reason, the sun, you might say, is a cosmic body that both maintains order in the solar system and brings order into the forces pervading our material system. Just as we can establish the connection of individual planets to the metals, as I described earlier, we can also establish that there is a connection between the sun and gold. In this instance, too, the ancients valued gold for its connection to the balance between spirit and matter rather than for its aramonic value. It is important to always keep in mind that in the natural world, things that we separate both in our thoughts and in anything we accomplish on earth are always united in some way. In our thoughts, we separate what is subject to gravity, and therefore tends toward salt formation, both from the bearers of light, which tend toward the effects of light, and from what forms the basis of the balance between the two. There is no such separation, however, in the natural world. In nature, these ways of working are united with one another and interpenetrate, forming very intricate structural systems. These intricate edifices are present in the gleam of gold, because through gold, in a certain way, the spiritual element in its pure form looks into the outer world. This makes us aware of something I would like to note parenthetically, because you may be able to work very fruitfully toward putting the impulses that can still be gained from ancient medical literature to good use in modern literature. If you write dissertations such as those I mentioned yesterday, ancient literature will offer many a stimulus if you understand it correctly. It is extremely important to note that this ancient literature sees three principles, the salt-like, mercurial, and phosphoric, or sulfur-like, principles, coming together in some sort of connection in every substance. We must also note that the ancients were very concerned with separating these three principles out of any substance. They held the view that lead comes about, as we have indicated here, but that lead, just like gold or copper, contains all three principles, the salt-like, the mercurial, and the phosphoric. The important point here is that we can use these principles to treat the human being if we extricate them from their combinations in some way. In ancient chemistry, the greatest care was devoted to this process, which was found to be most difficult in the case of gold. This is the reason for the Latin saying, "Facilius est aurum facere quam destruere," parenthesis, "it is easier to make gold than to destroy it," close parenthesis. This is really one of the examples that makes us revere ancient knowledge, because people thought that the three essential principles of nature, the salt-like, the mercurial, and the phosphoric, were so strongly connected to each other in gold that it would be more difficult to extract them from that substance than from any other. It is absolutely true that if we ourselves were to proceed today exactly as the ancients did in the process of extricating these three principles of nature, it would not be easy for us to accomplish it. But if we totally disregard ancient knowledge, as should happen in these lectures, after all, we are shedding only occasional light on the ancient literature, and investigate what can still be researched today, we discover that in order to extract these three necessary principles from natural substances, the substances in question must undergo a certain process of combustion. Through this combustion process, for example, the fire-bearing, light-bearing principle is driven off first. For certain purposes, we would then have to continue extracting the mercurial principle from these natural substances, so that in the end, everything remaining tends in the direction of the salty principle and can be extracted with an acidic substance, yielding a truly salt-like remedy, whether from plants or from minerals. I will go into more detail later. Thus, we must either look for a light-bearing substance in nature from which to derive the extra telluric element, attempt to extract this extra telluric element from earthly substances, leaving behind the truly salt-like components, if those are what we need, or try to extract a substance that represents the balance between these two poles. At this point, we can take either one of two routes, which are different in character, even though both lead to the same goal, at least to a certain extent. It is also possible to take both routes. We can take the perspective of ancient physicians, who were always intent on extracting what they viewed as phosphorus, salt, or mercury from familiar substances and then making use of it. For them, the distinct and specific effects of remedies resulted from differences between them that were due to their having been derived from lead or from copper. That is, they took the origin of the substance into account. As far as they were concerned, when they produced a salt from lead, it was different in character from a salt produced from copper. Even when they said salt, they meant that the particular salt was one of a variety of salts. Simply by being a salt, it was earthly. But by being a salt derived from one of a variety of metals, it was extra telluric and had a connection to the varied aspects of the human being that we will be able to characterize first thing tomorrow. This is one of the routes that medicine can take in producing salt-like remedies. We can also take the route that was chosen after the ancient route was obscured, but at a time when people still had the distinct feeling that the human being was more than just a test tube. In this case, we simply attempt to take what is present and to make the underlying forces in existing substances useful through potentization. This is the method inherent in Hanuman's school of thought in particular. It represents a new ascent away from the entire school of medical thinking that developed after the old ways had been obscured, when people no longer knew anything about any supra-earthly connections or the like. This is the reason for the desperation of the modern medical profession, that modern medicine no longer looks at the extra-telluric element that underlies the earthly, and always attempts to make do with exclusively earthly substances and forces. The homeopathic system attempts to transcend this limitation, as do physical or naturopathic methods of therapy, which resort to direct applications of mercury, light, or air, because they no longer have access to insight into the right way of using phosphorus, the light bearer, or the carriers of air. Of course, this constitutes a third route. But a true and favorable route will open up again only when spiritual science allows us to penetrate once more the connection between the mineral element and the supra-earthly, between the plant kingdom and the supra-earthly, and between the animal kingdom and the supra-earthly. By the time we get to the animal kingdom, as I pointed out yesterday, we are already questionably close to the human being. The ancients drew the line here at a boundary that we must seek to re-establish on the basis of more recent research. They said that plants lie within the realm of the solar system, as do minerals, but that when we get to the animal world, we leave the solar system and are much less free to experiment with the things we find there in ways that are permissible, as long as we remained within the planetary realm of extra-telluric activity. The forces leading to the development of animals, and especially of humans, are much farther away and much more spread out in the cosmos than the forces in minerals and plants. The ancients drew the zodiac as a boundary so that people would not look for therapeutic forces beyond what was present in plants or minerals, or would at least be aware that they were entering a questionable zone. Today, however, this zone has been entered along a route that I began to characterize yesterday. We will discuss this in more detail when we come to specialized aspects of pathology and serotherapy. Such routes usually lead to detailed measures, and as a consequence, they call forth very strong illusions that completely mask the dangers lurking behind them. The end of Lecture 6.